Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Volition Rx, a multinational epigenetics company revolutionizing cancer diagnosis with the development of simple, easy-to-use, cost-effective blood tests involving a range of cancers and other diseases. Volition's clinical trials in human health have shown promising results in detecting several cancer types, including colorectal, lung, and a variety of bloodborne cancers. Volition Rx. Web address, volition.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Oliver Morton, the briefings editor for The Economist magazine. In the midst of explaining where we came from, Oliver pauses at the cell, the life of the cell. And one way to look at the life of the cell is in large parts of our cycle. Human beings are part of the same cycle that butterflies and ferns and creatures that have no obvious name. They sort of grow everywhere in the world asexually. All of those creatures follow the same patterns. And I learned from Oliver to speak of the first pattern as when we become autonomous. The second pattern is when we endeavor to grow, growth. And the third pattern, when we come to reproduction. So, Oliver, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. I want to start philosophically with the end of the story, death, the death of the cell. You make a very philosophical point that human beings and killer whales, I don't know why we're paired, but we are, live a much longer time than just reproducing. And we live so long, we grow old and decrepit. That is our cells growing old and decrepit. What is the thinking of why we stick around so long? Good evening to you, Oliver.
Good evening, John. Well, there are a lot of there's a range of opinion, but the essence of the matter is that humans and complex animals and other creatures in general tend to be divided into two different types of cell. There are body cells or somatic cells, which actually do the work. And there are germ cells which pass the genes on to the next generation in the form of sperm or eggs. And in terms of evolution, it's the germ cells that count. It's when the genes get on to the next generation, that's what counts. And so after the point at which the body has stopped making new germ cells, stopped reproducing, there's little interest from an evolutionary point of view, one normally naively supposes, in keeping the body around very much. And lots of creatures are basically fertile until they die. But in humans and in killer whales, it does appear that, which are the, I think, two, if not the only two, two of the very small number of species where there's actually a menopause and an end to fertility, it appears as though the cultural benefit of having older, especially females, but older members of the social group seems to convey, one has to assume, some sort of survival basis. And so while the body does become decrepit, it's still, there's still some use to the individual beyond the use being made of that individual by the genes that that individual spreads to the next generation.
Let's go back to the beginning, because from philosophy, we go to the language itself. I said there were three phases: autonomous, reproduction, and growth and reproduction. You make a distinction early on that the world is divided between the sexual and the asexual. What is the asexual, and what is the advantage that the asexual enjoys?
Well, the advantage of being asexual for a creature, again, this is all part of the view of life that develops from what you could call, using Richard Dawkins' famous metaphor, the selfish gene theory, though that that covers some that can lead to some misunderstanding, because it doesn't mean that there are specific genes for selfishness. But from the genes' point of view, the genes that matter are the ones that get through to the next generation. And in an asexual creature, all the genes can get through to the next generation. And so you would think that since evolution is about which genes get through, the asexual way of reproducing would be the dominant form. However, it's also true that the world changes and that it's useful to generate novelty for the next generation. And it appears that sexual reproduction, although in sexual reproduction only half the genes from each parent go through to the next generation, they seem to do well enough for that to be a worthwhile price to pay for being an offspring. To lose half the genes seems like a huge loss of investment compared to making a replica of yourself. But half of your genes plus half of someone else's genes combined, if you do that enough, you will come up with versions that will do much, much better than you would have done. And this is particularly held to be the case in terms of disease and difficult circumstances, where it really may be necessary to try something radically new. So most creatures on Earth can't reproduce sexually, because most creatures on Earth are single-celled, and bacteria, which although they can swap genes, don't reproduce sexually in the way that animals and plants do. But of those that can reproduce sexually, many do so, and you know, in the animal kingdom, most do so, though some choose not to.
Let me translate into my commonplace language. We lose half the genome, which goes away, and in sexual reproduction, and we're taking the risk of linking to another half genome that may or may not introduce troubles. We take that risk each time. And
absolutely.
And you use the word inefficient. What compensates for the inefficiency? Is the novelty enough of a compensation?
The thought is that the novelty compensates for the inefficiency. And also, of course, depending on what sort of creature one is, you don't choose the other half of the offspring's genome entirely at random. Admittedly, in some creatures, that is effectively the case. But in humans and various other animals, you do actually go through some process of mate selection that may give you a better chance of getting a better half genome than you might just get at random.
I want to apply this thinking of this life of the cell to two creatures, to two constructions, to two autonomous ideas that have graphics in your article in The Economist so everyone can follow along. First, and I'm keen on both these, I have a fern garden and I grow plants in the summertime to attract butterflies. So we'll start with the fern. The fern has the life cycle of the cell that is comparable to everyone else. Is the fern considered a sexual creature with mating?
Oh, yes. The fern is a sexual creature with mating. What's interesting about the fern is that it has, as many plants do, has alternating generations. And so we talked about getting rid of half the genome. That's making the transition from diploid life, which is you and me, where we have basically two copies of every gene, which may be slightly different, one copy from each parent, and haploid life, where you have just one copy of each gene. Now, as far as humans are concerned, the haploid stage is very, very brief. There's a sperm, there's an egg, they're both haploid. They get together to make a diploid fertilized egg, back up to the full number of genes and chromosomes, and off you go again. Whereas for a fern, there's a whole body stage of being haploid, and so the spores from a fern, which are haploid, are spread out, and they find places to settle, and there they grow into an independent organism called a gametophyte. You have to—I've been noticing working on these pieces with colleagues who are genuine biologists, you have to have a love of some of these words to really be able to get through. And the gametophyte, it's that the gametophyte then gets fertilized or fertilizes to form a new diploid life form, and that becomes the fern that you recognize, which is the mature sporophyte, and then that all starts again. So it's not like going from making adults, making children that grow up into adults. It's adults making gametophytes that then have sex with each other to make sporophytes that grow up into adults. And so it's a much more complicated way of doing things. And more advanced plants than the fern have somewhat tempered the strangeness of this by keeping their gametophytes as part of their own body. But this is a basic thing about plant biology that just makes it interestingly different from that we undergo as animals.
Is the gametophyte that which I observe is in the ground through the winter and then regenerates the fern leaves in the springtime?
That would be I don't know very much about fern biology, but that would be my understanding, yes. It's the sporophyte that actually grows up and does the heavy-duty photosynthesis and makes the next generation of spores.
Does this cycle represent plant life in general? Does it go through this twist of regenerating?
Not all plants, but yes, this idea of having a gametophyte and sporophyte stage is common to most vascular plants. But as I say, in flowering plants of the sort that trees and flowers, you tend to get the gametophyte being as effectively sort of like built on to the sporophyte rather than going off and living its own independent life.
If I had to choose a creature to be from your essay, Oliver, I would choose the oak tree because it lives a long time and has an amazing ability to adapt.
I have a great sympathy for oak trees. There are old oak trees. There's an oak tree in the park near where I live in Greenwich, which was planted by Queen Elizabeth I and died in a storm about 30 years ago, but now there's another oak tree growing up out of it. And yeah, I think in order to take the long view, being an oak tree is a pretty good idea.
I'm speaking to Oliver Morton. He's the briefings editor of The Economist magazine, and we're talking about the life cycles of cells. When we come back, the other creature I'm most interested in is the butterflies. I'm observing them now because butterflies are brief-lived, and they have stages. One of them is the caterpillar stage. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.